Good afternoon, everyone. So this afternoon, I'm going to talk about the fourth and the last of these groups of contemplations, the fourth tetrad, which is the wisdom group. And these are sometimes called also the Dhamma group. So in a way, we have been contemplating the factors of impermanence and suffering and non-self, which are explored in this group of teachings throughout. But in this, as we get to the end of this, it becomes our primary focus. And we're really looking through the lens of wisdom, of seeing impermanence in our experience. Now, I think I might have already mentioned that this is a short retreat, and really, we're really just getting an overview. It's kind of giving a map of practice for us all to work with and to discover and explore where we are and how we're working in our practice, and give us some tools to continue and deepen. So I'm going to read these four verses. I'm going to talk most of all about the first of the four. So one trains oneself, focusing on impermanence. I breathe in. One trains oneself, focusing on impermanence. I breathe out. One trains oneself, focusing on fading away. I breathe in. One trains oneself, focusing on fading away. I breathe out. One trains oneself, focusing on cessation. I breathe in. One trains oneself, focusing on cessation. I breathe out. And one trains oneself, focusing on relinquishment. I breathe in. One trains oneself, focusing on relinquishment. I breathe out. Fading away, just in case you're worried, we don't kind of dissolve and disappear. These translations sometimes are less than perfect. I know a lot of work has gone into finding the right words, but it's really the grasping that's fading away. So impermanence. We all know about impermanence, and some of us really have experienced deep insight into the impermanence of the body, of the mind, of our experience. So we need to explore this and discover it deeply. It's transformative. We need to know it on a deeper level than intellectually. We need to see it with our inner eye. When we practice meditation, we're seeing impermanence with our inner eye. We look at the mind. We see how thoughts come and go. We discover how this mood, this dark funk that maybe I was in around something, some story that was going around in my mind, and then it's gone. It kind of just disappears. And in this anapanasati practice, we discover impermanence in each breath. So just that deep knowing, sensing, feeling each breath. We feel even within a single in-breath, there's change. It's got a texture. It's moving. It's flowing. An in-breath, an out-breath, it's gone. The next one arises. So what we explore, what our meditation research brings us to look at, is that there's no phenomena at all with a separate, lasting individuality. And this is not negative or positive. As Buddhadasa talked about, it's nature. This is the way things are. And when we're exploring Dhamma, we're exploring the nature of things. It's the law of how things are. So elements come together for a time because of certain conditions, and they're bound together because of certain conditions, and then they disappear because of conditions. So we can think of anything, just kind of looking at the environment. We look at a mountain, you know, and we think about mountains as something which are permanent. Well, they just have a much slower arc of change than we can take in through our senses. And so for us, they look permanent. But of course, they've come together through shifting tectonic plates or maybe glacial movements, and then they're eroded over a long, long arc of time. And when we go to mountains and we look at the rock that's there, you know, we can see that which is a mountain was once, you know, the sedimentary rock tells us the story that it was once the bottom of an ocean, right? Zen Master Dogen said, if you do not know that mountains walk, you have not seen mountains. So it's the same with living beings. Conditions come together to create a living being, and we tend to, you know, see a living being, a human being, or an animal as something that has its own separate existence. But it's also a coming together of conditions. You know, and this, in talking about impermanence, I'm going to talk about them kind of sequentially, but impermanence or anicca and unsatisfactoriness, suffering, or dukkha, and the selflessness of things, anatta. These are all really different aspects of one truth. And so when conditions come together to create a human being, or a dog, or a fish, so forces are continually acting on a being, and changing it, and so the wear and tear of a body, the genetic programming of our bodies. You know, why is it that a dog will live you know, maybe maximum 15 years. You know, it's so mysterious. And human beings are, you know, genetically programmed to live, you know, what is it, 70? But of course, so many of us don't. So many die because of other conditions. So, one of the ways that one of the metaphors or analogies maybe to this impermanence is, you know, are taken from the discourses are like the froth on an ocean wave. You know, we see that. We see a wave, you know, and we know that it's just there for an instant, and then it goes back into the ocean, and that's analogous to a life or any manifestation of life, a tree, a flower, a whirlpool in a river. You know, it comes together because of certain conditions. And it's made of the river. It's not made of different elements than the river. It is the river. And so we are the coming together of earth elements or elements of our world. Sometimes they're talked about as four or five elements: earth, air, water, fire, space. So we cling to that which cannot be clung to. It's like reaching into a river and trying to grasp the river. It's a current. It's a flow. You know, we see that in relationships. It's really hard to have a relationship that lasts, isn't it? You know, we have to be, sometimes people change, and sometimes we change. And that which was holding us together in relationship just, you know, falls apart. Sometimes we're changing and the other person can't change with us. And that's so that creates a lot of sadness and sense of loss and stress. But it's understandable. It takes huge commitment to have an enduring relationship. Acceptance of how the other is changing, acceptance of the changing conditions of our lives. And I'm not just talking about, you know, a couple. I'm talking about friendships and relationships between parents and children. All kinds of different relationships that we want them to endure because they give us a sense of stability. And you know, there's a joy in having a long-term relationship with somebody who knows your journey. And it really does take commitment to, and even when there's commitment, sometimes just whatever's changing and whatever forces there are acting on the relationship just pull it apart. So it's that can be a source of suffering when we're trying to hold on to it, when we feel that there's something wrong or bad that the relationship didn't endure. Or especially when we blame ourselves or blame the other. So we can see how, in so many ways, impermanence is linked to dukkha. These three Pali words. I mean, I've named some Pali words, but these three are particularly helpful, I think, to remember, because anicca, dukkha, anatta, they kind of, the English words just don't kind of encompass the breadth and the depth of these as we explore them and come to understand what they mean in our own experience. Dukkha especially, I think, points to a whole spectrum of experience that is as I was just describing, comes out of trying to hold on to what can't be held on to, but it also comes out of the vicissitudes of life, that life really can be terribly painful. And often when, you know, as Buddhists living in a relatively, and all of our lives are different, and some people have hardship and difficulty in their lives, but for the most part, we don't have bombs raining down on us. We don't have soldiers coming in and pulling our families out of the house and killing them. We don't have, you know, like we're not starving to death. So dukkha, like in the extreme of pain and suffering, it can be very intense. It's very hard to not suffer when you're starving, or when you know, there's such violence around us. And it's, you know, and the teachings, especially in the Tibetan tradition, the teachings around, you know, how can we practice the Dharma, you know, point to these extreme conditions of suffering as ones which make it, you know, very, very difficult to practice the Dharma. You know, when there's not, you know, any peace, when there's, you know, so much uncertainty in our lives, so many threats. So, you know, it's really important to, I think, acknowledge and be grateful for the stability that we do have in our society, in our lives, even if it's far from perfect for, you know, for some of us. And we do experience, you know, many of us experience a sense of isolation or marginalization or financial uncertainty, a feeling of scarcity perhaps, or oppression, racism, prejudice. So there are, even in our own society, there are forms of suffering that are present around us that some of us may not see, may not be tuned into, because, you know, we're not directly affected. And Buddhist teachers actually are really trying to grapple with this now and to explore, you know, how can, as Buddhism takes root in the West, how can we as Buddhists really respond? How can we bring these teachings into engagement with the real social problems that we see around us, suffering that is around us? How can we make a unique contribution to the seeking of peace and justice in our society, which doesn't just perpetuate division, perpetuate blaming, perpetuate hatred? You know, can we come from a place of love? Can we come from a place of connection? And a lot of the ways that we talk about dukkha, have to do with just the instability, the uncertainty of our lives. And of course, aging and illness, these are all so challenging. And why are they challenging? It's not because there's something wrong with aging and illness and death. It's not that, what's gone wrong here? I'm getting older. There's a mistake. This shouldn't be happening. Or I'm sick. I have an illness. My body is breaking down in some way, not working properly. We see it all around us. As Buddhadasa says, it's the way of nature. And also, all things, the Buddha says this again and again in the discourses, all things that come together, all composite things, come apart. So it's our clinging, it's our wanting things to be other than how they are that creates the stress and suffering. And so being with things as they are is the way of wisdom. And accepting and even embracing, impermanence, and recognizing the source of dukkha, recognizing where it comes from. And then anatta is also part of this kind of gem, three-faceted gem, or truth. So, one of the ways that I, a very simple way that I like to illustrate anatta, or non-self, is inspired from Thich Nhat Hanh and the way he talks about seeing with the eyes of wisdom. So when we see an object, we think it has a certain existence, like we might not talk about this as a self, but we see it as an object, and it has its its separate existence. So we our perception tells us, and we might say, that's the bell striker, and we don't think of it as something that is selfless. But then when we look at it with the eyes of wisdom, we can say, it's made from wood, and this wood came from a tree with its roots in the earth, drawing minerals from the earth, and its branches reaching toward the sun and taking in, by photosynthesis, the energy of the sun. And so in this striker, there's the sun and the earth. There's also, this was made according to a kind of a learned, there's a skill in this, it's a certain shape, it's a certain size, it's just the right size for your hand to hold it, the right thickness, it's made on a lathe. So it arises interdependently with human beings, with human skills, with human intelligence and ingenuity. And the capacity for humans to communicate and invent things like a lathe that will make these little, places where it goes in, simple but lovely design. And then we can continue looking at this striker, and we can, maybe we can ask ourselves, you know, who made it? Who made it? You know, did it come from a faraway country, maybe? Were they paid a just wage? You know, how many of these does the person who made this have to make in a day in order to live? And what are the conditions under which this person worked? And what is the, you know, how are the resources from which this is taken, the trees, how, you know, are they planted sustainably? And what's the footprint? What's the greenhouse gas footprint of this? You know, how many thousands of miles did it come? So when, you know, and then when we look at the human component and all of the interconnected life from which, you know, this emerges, you know, we can not only see the earth, but we can see the whole universe, because, you know, the minerals, which are the essential elements in our bodies, are only created in the birth of stars. And so we are stardust, and this bell striker is also part of that. So I can't pull this in any direction in which it's not connected to everything. You know, this is connected to everything. And so this simple object is connected to everything, and so are we with all our complex thoughts and understandings and beliefs and attitudes and perceptions. So, you know, our perceptions about what is good, what is acceptable, what is beautiful, what is unacceptable, what is ugly. They're all received from somewhere. And so there's nothing that's not connected to everything else. And further, you know, on another level of teaching on what the meaning of anatta. So we have the interconnectedness of things. We have the truth that, you know, if something doesn't endure through time, if it's always changing, can we say that it really has a self-existence? You know, can I really say that when I look at a picture of myself as a baby, you know, and I say, well, that was me, you know, is that really me? It's, you know, that none of the cells that existed in my body were, you know, are present in me now. There's a DNA, which is, you know, continues a pattern of replication in a certain way. So there's some continuity, but so much is different, is changed. And certainly, you know, my understanding, my attitudes, my way of being has changed profoundly since when I was younger. So, impermanence, interdependence. And then there's another way in which we can talk about non-self. The world is coming into being. Life, all of life is coming into being. in the mind. So mind can't be separated from its object. So we look around and we think we see the world. We think we're in, you know, a certain world, and it has a certain kind of shape, and really, what is creating that world to come into being? First of all, it's our sense organs. So we see a certain range of light. There's a range of light that we don't see. So we're not seeing everything that's there. We hear a certain range of sound. We have capacity to feel certain kinds of touch. And certainly, when I take my dog for a walk, I know that she is in a world of smell that I will never know. And so her world is very different from mine. So all of these experiences are coming into reality through our sense consciousness. And our feelings are arising. Feelings are always arising with an experience. So like, I don't have a feeling of pleasant without a sense experience that it connects to. I don't have a feeling of unpleasant without some kind of sound or touch sensation that unpleasant feeling tone is arising. Co-arising is the word that's used in Buddhist teaching. So in this exploration of non-self, we can say that, you know, the world is arising in consciousness, in our minds, and the mind is also the manifestation of the world. So the subject and the object, you know, that it kind of, the dualism of subject and object, you know, doesn't hold when we look deeply. So I found that something that in my own practice has brought a deep sense of intimacy with all of life, you know, that we're so close, that we can't be separated. Again, Dogen said, enlightenment is intimacy with all things. So we want to separate ourselves and say, no, that's not me. You know, and yet, in so many ways, we're interconnected. So these wisdom factors are, you know, we bring these, we begin to see impermanence and dukkha, anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, selflessness. We begin to see it in our experience, you know, as we examine our mental states, our reactivity, you know. So, you know, anger arises, and then with mindfulness, you know, we can breathe and be with it, and we see that it goes. You know, we have a beautiful experience. We're watching a beautiful sunset, you know, and so, you know, we, pleasure arises, enjoyment, and we can be present with it, breathe, and we see that also fades away and changes. And so we learn these, and then now we're in the progression of this discourse, we're bringing it to a deeper level in which this investigation becomes the primary object. And the progression that's given in the discourse is that when we begin to deeply see anicca, dukkha, anatta, that we stop grasping at things. You know, we stop trying to grasp and hold on to things that we think are going to make us happy. You know, and sometimes we learn this just in our ordinary lives. Like one story that that I tell sometimes is that, you know, when my son was 18, he wanted to get a motorcycle. That was his dream. You know, he dreaming about it for years, and finally, you know, he saved money, and when he was 18, wasn't mom didn't want him to do it, but he did get it, and the dream became not a nightmare, but he realized the dukkha of, you know, having this thing that he had to maintain and pay for and repair and be careful about and protect and that doesn't get stolen, all of these things. So, you know, we learn this in our maturing to a certain extent. At least many of us do, not everyone. but with this, you know, deep practice, we really, there's really this fading away, the grasping, the pushing away, the craving, the blaming, all of these, the jealousy, all of these kind of suffering states of mind begin to fade away because you know, we see through them. We see they're impermanent. We see the suffering of them, and we see that they're coming from a sense of self, which is, you know, just it's a misperception. So fading away. And cessation is just that kind of that we're really just fully present in our lives. We're not kind of always leaning into the next experience. We're not always leaning into the next thing we can get or avoid. Sometimes the word suchness is used, that things are just as they are, and we see them in their beauty, in their perfection. Even, you know, as I was doing in the guided meditation, even in all, you know, the warts and all, you know, even in all the impermanence, the falling apartness, the maybe the ways that if we were getting into preference, we would prefer that they not be. But there's a presence with everything as it is. Suchness or thusness is sometimes called. And then the final one is relinquishment, focusing on relinquishment. I breathe in. And I... the way Buddhadasa talks about this relinquishment, I really like, because he says that if you translate it, kind of more literally, it really means tossing back. So he's saying, you know, we had this idea that there was somehow this me and mine, you know, me and mine. And we try to hold on to things and hold on to this body and all these ideas about self. And then when we realize it's all part of nature, it all belongs to nature, it's not me or mine, you know, we kind of, okay, toss it back, you know. I can't hold it. I remember when I first went on a Vipassana retreat at the Insight Meditation Society. It was my first retreat back there, back in the 90s, and I heard Joseph Goldstein give a talk, and he was talking about his at the time that he spent practicing in India, and he told this little story about a radio that he had brought with him, and he was, you know, kind of listening to the radio and, you know, wanting to stay a little bit in touch with the world back, and you know, listening to the news and that kind of thing. And then one day he, you know, he put it somewhere and he wasn't paying attention, and, you know, it was gone, like India, right? You know, that's the way it is. And he said, and I was really upset. He said, because I thought it was mine. And it took me a while to understand that. But, well, yeah, it was yours. But then I got it. I got it. Yeah. So what I, you know, what we have here is a map, and we're all practicing, you know, in different places where we are. We all have the conditions of our lives. Some are very demanding, some are very difficult. Conditions of our families, our own bodies, our work, the place that we live, you know, so many different conditions that we're working with. And so it's not that, you know, we need to always be in this exalted place of seeing, you know, from a place of perfect wisdom that this is impermanent. This is selfless, and, you know, like it's suffering to try to grasp it. But it's more and more, you know, we can connect with these teachings, and even just coming back to the breath, and finding our home in the body, and resting, finding a little bit of space, a little calmness, noticing that when, you know, a mental state arises, if we don't get hooked into it, you know, it will pass. It will pass away. And gradually wisdom deepens, and the Dharma takes, kind of carries us to a deeper awareness, a deeper way of being. A more, as Buddhadasa says, a way of being which is aligned with the truth of life, the truth of nature.